Hey there, Freedom Fighters. My name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy, where I interview entrepreneurs about how they built their businesses. As soon as Corona hit, I saw this dude, Andy DiDerossi, start to sell hand sanitizer online. And at the time, I thought, there's some whack jobs out there who are doing something, but they feel so weird and different. And to be honest with you, I also thought maybe it's a little too soon to do it. And as I kept, like, for some reason, repeating what he tweeted, the photos, the aspiration, the thing, it just gave me the sense of admiration for him. And I finally just asked him to do an interview, and he ignored me. And I thought, there's no way that a guy who's doing this has the time. I totally understand it. I didn't take it personally. But it turns out that he actually followed up via text a little afterwards and said, sure, let's do it. And the reason that I was able to connect with him is we were introduced through Jason Fried, the founder of Basecamp, who is now, Andy, I guess he's your boss, huh?
Yeah, 100%.
Is it weird to have a boss for an entrepreneur like you?
No, not this one. Just because he gets it, you know, he understands like the autonomy needed to figure out something like marketing for Basecamp, and a normal boss wouldn't work. This is different.
I'm so curious about whether you're even working for him. Like, every once in a while, I'll see you say, oh, I just saw your eyes do something when I said that. I told you I was going to look at your face to see if I've crossed the line.
Does that feel like,
yeah, does it feel like maybe I've insulted the work that you've done there, or no? How many hours a week would you say you spend on Basecamp, which is your full-time job now?
Oh, 40, 45 hours. Yeah.
Wow. Oh, okay. And then how many hours a week would you say you spend on Detroit Hand Sanitizer Company?
Probably like 25, 30.
Okay.
I'd say, you know, it's a lot of like in the early morning before things get started, and then afterward, you know, picking stuff up and making, because we still have a ton of employees, you know, like Detroit Bus Company employees who, you know, used to do bus stuff and now they do sanitizer stuff.
That's another thing that he did. He saw that there was a light rail system that was closing down in Detroit, and he decided he was going to buy three buses and created a bus company. I invited Andy here to talk about how he did this. And in preparation for this interview, I read a little bit about some of his background and the entrepreneurial stuff he's done. And I want to spend some time on that, because all this stuff fires me up and gives me this sense of optimism in the world, and also a sense of, well, there are possibilities out there, Andrew. Just find them and go along with what moves you. This interview, where we're going to find out what moved Andy and helped him change the world, is sponsored by two phenomenal sponsors. The first is ClickFunnels, which does not want me to tell you about ClickFunnels. They just want me to tell you that they've got a podcast themselves. It's called Traffic Secrets, and that you should listen, and I agree. And the second is a company that you've heard me talk about a lot for hiring developers. It's called TopTal. Andy, is it gauche for me to ask you how much money, how much revenue you've made from selling hand sanitizer?
I wish I even knew. And I could probably pull it up, but then I won't tell you.
Really?
You know, I'm a privately held company. I mean, it's,
would you give me a sense of proportion? Like, are we talking about hundreds of thousands, millions of dollars?
No, not millions. No. We've sold 14,000 gallons, either in gallons, half gallons, or quart sizes. So, you know.
And what is it, $50 per gallon from what I remember?
$44.99. So if we do a little lazy calculator situation.
Times how many gallons?
14,000 gallons. So
14,000.
Like, I mean, and if you do the math on that, that's 630,000. Yeah.
And when people buy half gallons, it costs a little bit more per gallon, right?
Per ounce, yeah. And then we donate a ton of it. So part of that 14,000 is a lot of the donated product to you know, police departments and fire stations and senior centers.
What was it that you saw that made you say, I got to do something here?
Well, I mean, there's a big nationwide shortage of all kinds of things, sanitizer and masks and toilet paper. And we all know the things that are really hard to get a hold of. And I actually first looked into making masks. I, you know, called some companies in the Southeast about what it would be to make a machine. You need a melt blown non-woven fiber machine, you know, and, turns out to be about $5 million to stand one of those up. So that's not going to fly. And then, you know, can't make toilet paper, don't have a sawmill. But I got a hold of the formula for sanitizer, and it looked reasonable. You know,
I mean, just looked it up online and you saw it.
Yeah. Google's a hell of a thing.
Can I just ask you, like, psychologically, it seems to me like you, for me, I said, somebody's got to do something about this. Purell better like step up, but there's something in you that makes you say, let me investigate and see what I could do. Where the hell does that come from?
I think it's a mix of my favorite driving concept, which is if anyone can do it, and anyone can do it. Like if there's someone in the world out there who built a sanitizer plant, that means humans can do it, you know, and
but,
it's probably,
but don't you in your head say, yeah, but those people have scientists, they've got this approval or that approval, and they've got experience here, and no one's, and people trust them because they're Purell or Clorox or Lysol. No, you don't have any of that.
Well, that's the beauty of a bureaucracy, is that the EPA and the FDA can't just say, well, big company A gets permission and little company C does not. You know, there has to be a clearly published list of rules on what you have to do. So we went down the list. We, you know, got equipment or processes to fulfill each requirement by the FDA and just made our way through it. I mean, it's kind of the same with anything. Like if, you know, Ford Motor Company came out of a guy from a shed actually on the street that I'm on right now here in Detroit, like, it all goes back to something. It goes back to a moment. I can't name a single company that didn't come out of a moment.
I guess I think that the instinct that most people have without being aware that they're thinking it is, it's going to be too much bureaucracy. Oh, there's going to be, I'm going to get it as far as possible, but these guys don't know what it takes. And I wonder where in your makeup you decided, I'm not going to think that way, or you just naturally stopped thinking that way.
I think it's a healthy dose of ignorance too, you know, like, it's just, if you know how hard something's going to be, like, you're just not going to do it. And so you kind of just have to dive in.
Okay.
But also,
Go ahead, sorry.
I started on a level that we could have completely failed and it would have been fine. You know, I started with 4 drums of isopropyl alcohol, which was like, I don't know, $3,500. If I completely screwed that up and that was complete, it goes down the drain, literally. That's not that bad. It's, you know, and so we did that. It sold quickly, did 6 drums, sold quickly, did some totes, which are 300-gallon, you know, containers of raw alcohol that sold. And so, you know, then I started renting semi trucks worth, you know,
let me start at the beginning then. Do you, at what point in your day do you sit down and you go over this? Is it like you on your phone when you're in the bathroom saying like, what if I could do this? Or is there time before going to sleep? This is, I know this sounds basic, but
no, I understand. Yeah. It's a lot like the little in-between moments. You know, you don't really sit down with your grand pad of paper and you say, I'm going to come up with an idea. You know, it is in the in-betweens. It's in the driving moments. It's in the shower. It's in the, you know, the sort of littoral spaces of your day where your brain is typically doing something else. You know, I have a lot of my best ideas when I'm taping boxes, you know, because your monkey mind is occupied doing the you know, the manual thing,
yeah,
and your creative mind can go off and just explore possibilities. I mean, even outside of sanitizer, we've thought about tons of other things. You know, we want to make just a full line of stuff that people can find useful in this pandemic. The demand for sanitizer right now is like, I would say like 2x like normal, you know, which is a lot, double literally, but when economies start reopening, we're going to be at 6x, you know, that's really what we're thinking. And so Purell and Gojo and all them are not going to stand up that much production capacity in the time that it needs to be done. It's also a heavy product, you know, it's difficult to distribute. And so the closer you are to the source where it's made, the better. A lot of cleaning products come from China, and this is just a fact that they come in giant containers from China, and those aren't coming. So we need more domestic production capability. So all these things combined, you go back to first principles, it's not a bad idea.
So you put together a list of things, the ingredient list. You said, can I do this? How do I buy? Is it isopropyl alcohol that you needed to buy in order to make the first batch? You did?
Correct. Okay. That's the limiting reagent. That's the thing that you need. That's the hardest to get. You need the most of.
So how did you
get
it?
The rest of it is, I called everywhere.
Just started making phone calls all day.
I called all day. Well, I thought, okay, chemical supply, cool. Called all them. They all said, no way. We're fully allocated. I've heard that phrase 100 times, fully allocated. So then I thought, well, who would maybe use this stuff? You know, who would have it on hand, or who might be like a lower level distributor? And I actually found it was a weed equipment store. They sell basically equipment for, you know, weed technologists to extract THCs, and I don't know a lot of it, but
okay. They
need the isopropyl to clean the equipment, and also to clean bongs and stuff. So they had like 4 drums on hand, and they had the ability to buy more from the distributor. And so I was just buying it from them at an enormous markup, but we could get it, you know? So I'd put it in the back of my pickup truck, drive some over.
Okay.
Yeah. And so that's how we got started. And then they ran out. They weren't allowed to buy anymore. They just, you know, they were fully allocated.
Okay.
So we, again, back to the phone. I mean, a straight week of just calling and email and a lot of no's, you know?
All right. I get now how you think about this stuff. The people were already there, I guess, because of the Detroit Bus Company?
Yeah. So we have a staff of 38 at the Busco. But at that point, everybody was laid off. It was just me in a box, which is, you know, part of why I can take some time to think about some of this stuff sometimes is that, like, you know, I was doing my normal base camp work. Bus company's doing nothing. Evenings are open, you know. Originally, we were looking at, like, what would a grocery delivery system look like? Kind of a, you know, a low-cost, like, Detroit Pony Express kind of a thing. Because right now, all the shopping services are kind of premium, you know, as far as cost goes. It's a difficult thing to provide. So we thought about if we made like a rolling bodega, so you don't have to order, it just shows up in your neighborhood. Cool, right? But logistically very difficult, and keeping food temperature stable and making sure that we keep our employees safe, it's very, very hard. So that energy, that want to do something, turned into the sanitizer project.
You know what? There was a time, from what I read, when you weren't thinking this way. I read that at 16 years old, you were a busboy at some Italian restaurant in the suburbs. You were making $6 an hour. Is that right?
$4.25. Yeah.
$4.25. Is that minimum wage even?
No, no. But for the service industry, you can pay less than minimum because they're getting tipped, which is evil and wrong. But yeah.
Yeah, I used to work for less than minimum wage only because I was underage, and anyone who'd hire someone who's underage is breaking the law anyway. So they might as well break the law and pay you a little bit less.
Just break it double. Yeah. No, a lot of servers make like $2 and something cents an hour, you know?
Okay.
Busboy's a little more because we don't get tips directly. We get pity from the servers. So
they threw you a couple of bucks. It's still
good old days.
It's a tiny amount of money. And then I guess a friend told you about a police auction that was near you, and you decided to go and do what with that?
Well, we found that there was a police auction for cars that had been abandoned. So somehow a car ended up somewhere, the police towed it, and that's the end. Like, you don't know why these cars are there, but they're in really bad shape. They're very old. But they're $100 a piece. And I, you know, at 16 years old, I'm like, a car for $100? Like, this has to be worth more than $100. Like, it just has to be, you know, there's some natural law. I don't know. Cars can't be worth $100.
Yeah.
So, went to our first auction, and my buddy who was 18 bought three of them for me. You know, I gave him the money. He bought
them. Because you were underage.
Because I was underage. You can't buy them when you're under 18. So, you know, dragged them back, used my AAA membership to get the two that wouldn't run back, drove the one back. Out of the three, one was salvageable. I paid $300 for the three of them. And one, I went through, I you know, cleaned it up. I shortly after working as a busboy, I got a job at an auto garage. And so I, you know, was cleaning their tools and sorting things and carrying parts and doing very, very minor maintenance stuff, nothing serious. But I was around the cars, so I had the confidence to, I don't know, try to work on one myself. So fixed up the one and sold it for $1,200 cash, which was like, you know, it was like Pablo Escobar money back then. It was, you know, 16 years old, $1,200 is a lot of money.
Yeah, I heard you gave a speech at one point where you said, I laid the $20 bills on the counter in front of my mom, and I felt like I was a drug dealer with all this cash. But I also read that you said, that's the point where I realized my work does not have to depend on the number of hours that I spend. Is that a break for you? Is that a significant moment for you, or am I dramatizing it?
No, huge moment. I mean, really, absolutely. Like, it's when I found that I could get paid for ingenuity, when I could get paid for, you know, the value of my ideas and execution versus time and a clock. You know, if you make $15 an hour, you know, your earning potential between 40 hours and 50 hours is not that different. You know, if you work 60 hours, like, yeah, I got some overtime, but like, you really can't break out of that. Now, for a lot of people, that's great. Like, they prefer to have the straightforward hourly job. You know, you leave at 5 o'clock, you slide down the proverbial dino tail, and you leave work behind. You know, like, work is not the goal, but I've always wanted to do something bigger. You know, it just, I don't know if it's an authority complex or if it's, you know, just ego driven thing that I would just want to do something bigger. You know, so here I am. So I just keep placing these bets. You know?
I wonder what Detroit was like when you were growing up. But first, let me take a moment to talk about my first sponsor. It's a company called ClickFunnels, which, as I said, they don't want me to tell you that ClickFunnels is the best way to create landing pages, which it is. It did over $1 million. They don't want me to tell you that. They want me instead to tell you that they've got a podcast of their own. Let me ask you, Andy, you're thinking about, for Basecamp, the project management software, buying ads in podcasts. Am I right? And that's why you were asking about it?
Yeah, well, we want to buy ads in places that aren't tracked, because we don't want to track users. We don't want open rates. We don't want basically any of the analytics that most marketers want, because we believe in privacy over conversions. You know,
What? It makes me so uncomfortable. Even for ClickFunnels, they bought this ad. They want me to send people to their podcast app and go and download the podcast. And I don't know, did I do a good job or not? How good a job did I do? I can't believe that you guys don't care about that.
Well, it's not that we don't care about the business outcomes, because we do enjoy good business outcomes, because it enables us to have a stable business and to pay people fairly and to grow and to build other products. But it's not worth the trade-off for people's privacy. It's just, we've gotten into click pixels and emails, or click trackers and emails, and open pixels being just standard fare, where just because we send something means we need to track who opens it and then affect what we send to them based on if they open it or not. You know, once you send that, it's up to them to let you know if they want to engage more. You know, when you send a letter, you know, like a simple postal, you know, letter, not with delivery tracking or anything, you don't find out what happens to that. You know, it's up to them if they want to respond to you. You know, you got to give them some space.
I got to hand it to you guys at Basecamp. At least you really do whatever it is that you believe in. You stick with it. It's just sometimes like, come on, guys, don't you see the power? But all right, you do see the power. Let me come back to this ad. So then I've got all these ideas for what you should be doing with podcast ads. I'll tell you what it is. But here's what I should be doing right now, which is telling everyone that what they're doing over at ClickFunnels is saying, look, we're in an environment where people need to find customers, but they don't necessarily want to find them in all these new places and spend a lot of money. So they're trying to find ways. They're trying to show you that there are ways to get customers right now, get users right now in the places that they already hang out. Within their podcast, they're going to show you how to find those customers. They're not doing a heavy sale on their software. Unfortunately, I think they should. Instead, they're just presenting these ideas. And if you want to continue with them, you'll find a way to continue with ClickFunnels. So where your dream customers are, it's in the podcast. Russell Brunson, the founder, is going to tell you why you don't need to create brand new traffic, why you can just go find the people where they are right now. He's going to tell you the number one metric that you need. You know what? Here's the thing. I don't want to give you a list of I've got a list here. I don't want to give them, Andy, a list of the things that they're going to get if they listen to the podcast. Here's what I say. Go subscribe right now. If it entertains you, you're going to continue to listen and this good stuff will come to you. If it doesn't entertain you, if it's not interesting, it doesn't, none of the points matter. Go look for traffic secrets right now in your podcast app. Make it the next listen that you listen to at some point in the day. If you love it, go on. If you don't, there's no guilt. Just move on. They don't even know that you stopped listening. It's Traffic Secrets by ClickFunnels. And Russell's a great storyteller and he uses the advice that he shares with you. So listen to what he's using himself and see if it makes sense for your business and will help you grow your traffic right now. So Traffic Secrets. What were your parents like growing up? What was Detroit like when you were growing up, Andy?
Well, I was born in 87. So like Detroit obviously was extremely depressed then. It was really on the slide as far as the auto industry goes, kind of at the end of it, right? My whole, you know, grandparents on both sides worked for the auto industry. My mom worked for, you know, Detroit Diesel for a while. You know, my mom had me when she was super young. She had me when she was, I think, 18. So, you know, she had to put herself through school and I was raised by my grandparents. So, you know, it's heard a lot of stories about General Motors and Detroit Diesel and, you know, what it's like working. They all worked in the offices, you know, nobody was like on the line. The car stuff just enters all of our consciousness. I mean, it's everything here, you know, and only recently have we somewhat, diversified, but not really.
You know, I used to go work with my dad. He ran a manufacturing company, manufacturing women's clothing. And every time he'd take me into a store, he'd let me watch what he was doing. He'd let me learn, but he'd always say, going in, do not do this for a living. I don't want my kids to get into this business because it's not a great business to be in at that level. Why did you decide to even stay in Detroit? Didn't your grandparents, didn't your mom say, get out of here? This makes no sense now. We're dying here.
No, they gave me the option, you know, and I traveled a bunch, 21 to 28, I traveled a ton. Mostly, you know, for a time there, I worked as an auto journalist for Jalopnik. And so I had press cars and, you know, we had a car from Ford that we could drive with unlimited fuel. So I saw a ton of the country. We'd go to New York and LA for a weekend, go down south, you know, go to the Northwest. I mean, every corner. And I like other cities. I think there's a lot of fun to be had in Portland and Austin and other places. But I'm also really big into roots. Like, I like knowing, you know, every block and every corner of the city and the people in it. I like forming deeper relationships. And so Detroit is an excellent home base for that.
Do you have your friends from high school?
I know some of the folks from high school, just a few, you know. I didn't engage that much in high school. I spent a lot of time in the auto shop.
Did I read that you dropped out?
I did not. I dropped out of college.
Okay.
I was a year and a half into university and I dropped out of that. But no, I finished high school. You know, I was one of the kids that always aced the test but never did the homework, you know, like just hated the homework. So, you know, get straight A's on the test, end up in AP classes, but, you know, C's and D's because you didn't do the homework.
Okay. I get a little bit of your background. Paper Street. You rented a hangar for what? And then I know you were kicked out because you didn't have an airplane in there and the FAA didn't want you to use it for non-aviation use. Why'd you rent it out in the first place?
Well, so there's a few stories mixed in there. The first, the hangar was at Detroit City Airport, and that was just for car stuff. That was actually prior to Paper Street. That was just before it. So
yeah, it was just you renting it out to do what?
Just to have all my car projects. You know,
Once you did three cars and one of them sold, you said, I'm going to stay with this?
Big time, yeah.
Wow, how big?
Yeah, I did a ton of them. Yeah.
Do you understand how weird you are? Like, this is like, everyone lives like this. So this is my, do you understand that what you're doing is, I mean that in the best way, that this is different, that you've got some kind of superpower view of the world that most people don't have? Or are you just saying, I'm going through life, I'm living my life, Andrew, back off?
It feels like the latter.
Yeah, I could see that. It's like,
it feels like the latter.
So this whole thing just escalated into how big a time?
Probably like, I don't know. I would say maybe like 25 cars over a couple of years.
Okay.
But I also started building race cars. So, you know, I found that if you had a shop, you could get the distributor accounts for a lot of these racing parts that I wanted to buy.
Okay.
So I got the distributorship so I could get cheaper parts. But I started selling them to friends. And, you know, I'd attend the street races and talk about our, you know, our shop. And it's called Team Deluxe. That goes way back.
That was your store, your shop.
That was the shop. Yeah.
Okay.
And so, you know, we'd call up these auto part manufacturers to make these racing parts and say, hey, we got a shop. It's 3,000 square feet. You don't have a distributor in Detroit. You know, would you like one? And they're always, you know, absolutely. Cause it's all upside for them, you know?
Uh-huh.
So they'd send all the collateral and some samples and, yeah. So that worked okay. I mean, that paid the rent on the building, but that was not a lucrative business because, you just needed to have so much more, you know, you needed so much equipment to really be like a performance racing shop, you know?
Okay.
So bought and sold the cars at this shop, had the hangar, was there for a while. A guy I kind of know rented the hangar next to me and he's the one that screwed it up for everybody because, he started parking cars out on the runway. That's a no-no. So the FAA came in and said, what the hell is going on here? So they kicked all of us scallywags out. That I had one more shop after that, and that's when Paper Street began.
The other shop had extra space, and you said, I'm going to start renting this out to my friends. Got it. That brought in more money. And then how did that turn into Paper Street, which is like an incubator? Am I right?
Yeah. This was really before like co-working and incubators and stuff were in vogue. So it was January 2010. I was looking around for spaces, and I found a 20,000 square foot building, which is, you know, a medium-sized building. And it hadn't been leased in a long time. So I made the landlord an offer You know, would you allow me to do this on a percentage basis? So I paid him 65% of the rents that came in, kept the other 35%. But one thing I didn't account for was the utility cost to keep that space heated. Well ate into that money. And the other thing that sucked is that when our lease was up, the landlord just said, okay, cool, thanks. Like, I'll take it from here. And he took all of our tenants, or tried to take all of our tenants, and turn it into, you know, just a you know, sublease situation for each of them. So, you know, I learned pretty quick that you are not gathering wealth when you are leasing. You know, you're just a buffer.
I kind of wonder that about, I'm in a Regis office. I wondered about that with the Regis. Are they really acquiring rent? Same thing, obviously, people have been thinking with WeWork.
Yeah. I think like a Regis and like a, what's the other one? There's another one.
I don't know them.
They're a stable business. They're very mature. You know, they understand their thing. And you're probably in some office park somewhere. I mean, you're not right downtown, right?
Like, oh, wherever you're right in the heart of the city.
You are. Oh, okay. Yeah. Usually the Regises are like somewhere where you're at like 13, 14 bucks a foot, you know, triple net. So,
I've been using them all over the world, and it depends. I do know that they've got some that are way out there, which sometimes I'll go to when I want to take a break. But, actually, I think today's my last day in here. I brought my bags in here for this interview, and I said, I'm clearing out this office. My lease is almost up. I might as well, if I can't work out of the office anyway.
Right. Yeah. Why keep one?
I feel kind of sad about that, to be honest with you. So why didn't you feel like a failure at that point? Why did you say, look, these things aren't working out. I've been spending so many years here starting these companies. Now this guy takes it away from me. I haven't built anything for myself.
Well, I mean, you know, what am I going to give up on? Like myself, you know, like you can't just like, you'd be like, oh, this whole Andy thing's a real failed project. You know, might as well throw in the towel on this whole Andy thing.
Maybe I don't have what I thought I had. I thought I was this creative person who was able to do something, but maybe I just need to be a $6 an hour or $4 and change an hour busboy. You don't go through that.
No, because the deal is like, the reason why that fell apart was because the landlord saw a chance to harvest more rent. And I saw it as a learning opportunity. I mean, I was absolutely very pissed off. I'm not saying I'm some monk. I'm like, well, here's some more knowledge. Like, no, I was enraged. You know, we talked about lawsuits, and half the tenants actually followed me to the next building, you know, so around the corner, I bought one building and leased another. And, you know, a bunch of the tenants followed, and that's rad, you know, people are willing to move all their stuff. But, you know, half of them stayed behind, and I don't hold any grudges. Like, they are renting their $300 a month office. You know, they want to stay put. Landlord makes them a deal. Sure, whatever, you know. But it gave me a chance to move to a different building. We learned a little bit about, you know, how this works. You know, I can't do a percentage deal. So for the next building we leased it at a flat number. You know, if you take the risk, then you get more upside. Mm-hmm. You know, if less risk, less upside. It's just a natural law. Okay. So,
all right. The next, so you picked yourself up pretty quickly then. We're talking within months.
Oh, I had a lot of shit. I mean, he had to move it like that day, you know. That's the problem. I think sometimes I've stayed in business since I was little because I just have a lot of stuff. I mean, I have some like tools and carts and vehicles and just crap that I've had since day one, and it has to live somewhere. So I'm like sort of always on the treadmill of needing to pay rent or a mortgage to somebody. It's like having this is a terrible analogy, but it's like having a kid. Like, you know, you have the kid, you're in it. Well, I'm in it now, so I'm going to, you know, do my best. I have to like feed and water and educate this child. You can't just get off the ride. So, you know, were there some months where I'd prefer to not have a lease payment? Like, absolutely. But it's kept me in the game, you know? So
yeah,
I am.
I do kind of feel like the kid analogy, it hits home for me. I've got kids, and I think that's a great analogy. I feel it. Then you had the velodrome, which I was hoping to get into, but I think that in the interest of time, we'll just say you bought a velodrome at one point
and borrowed it.
Okay. City, yeah. That is a place where people race bicycles. And then you read an article that said light rails are dead in Detroit or something like that.
Yeah. That. So this was a really tight, so 2010 in January, I started Paper Street.
So for Paper Street became more than just office space. It was an incubator where you were getting pieces of people's companies.
We weren't getting pieces of people's companies. So when we use the term incubator, is because it was affordable space in a community, you know, that you had a chance to work alongside other people doing the same thing. We had some shared resources, you know, the high speed internet, printers. This was before like co-working spaces were a thing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we call it an incubator. You might call it a co-working space now, but it was a little different because we had industrial spaces. You know, a lot of these joints don't have industrial spaces. You know, Regis doesn't have like a shop in the back you can rent. So we had 20 industrial spaces that people could rent. And people started motorcycle companies and bicycle repair companies and all kinds of stuff, you know. That was January 2010. Thunderdrome was October 2010. And then I started the bus company November 2011. I mean, it was a busy year.
So you said, look, they're closing down this rail system that people count on.
It was the other way around. Sorry to interrupt. It was that they were working to build one, and the money was allocated by the Fed, and the Fed said that they weren't going to fund it because there was no local leadership. You know, the suburbs wanted to be one thing, the city wanted to be another. The money is there, ready to, you know, move the shredders around, and the Fed said they can't do it because there's no local leadership. So the money went back to the general pool, got distributed to other, you know, other markets that work better.
Okay,
and that's infuriating. That some grown adults, you know, somewhere in some office somewhere running your city can't get it done. You know, they just can't get it across the finish line. That sucks.
And so you said, I'm going to do it?
Well, first I was just going to do it as a stunt to run the same route. I was actually planning to use one of those like fiberglass, like kid trains that you rent for a birthday party, you know, like a gas power. So it's the middle of winter. And so I'm like, you know, how do I do this? Called some places up. They're like, we might. I know this guy, his name, ironically, is Trainwreck. I know him from some circles here, and he was going to rent us his little train. But I'm always buying and selling equipment and just stuff. And I had a couple school buses in the back that I was selling for the local school system. They're just cool because they're.
You mean they had it to and said, can you, Andy, sell it for us?
Well, I reached out to them because they were selling 3 school buses in the like church weekly, and someone showed it to me and I was like, they're never going to sell these in like the church weekly. It's just not
right.
Who's
happen. Reading the church weekly saying I need 3 buses.
Just the Venn diagram of the weekly readers and the bus buyers. It's a sliver. Right?
How are you going to sell it for them? Or you were buying it to make a little bit of a profit, right? How are you going to sell it?
Well, no. So my whole thing is, in the middle there in 2011, I did some equipment buying and selling. There's like a big supermarket chain that went out of business. So I helped them sell a bunch of stuff online, which is really a function of take good photos, write good descriptions, get it onto Craigslist and eBay. You know, it's not rocket surgery. But if you've got a huge warehouse worth of stuff, like the labor to do that and to do it well and to handle the pickups and the payments and, you know, it's a whole thing. So I reached out to them about selling them on consignment, you know, bring the buses over here, I'll sell them for you. So when this transit thing came together, I thought, well, cool, I'll take one of these buses and I'll be the customer and I'll run it up and down this route just as a, you know, as a statement. You know, if a 22-year-old or however old I was then can do this, why can't you adults do it? You know, like what's so hard about this? I called the school system. I made a deal with them. I said, I'll sell the other 2 buses for you. 0 commission if I can have one. You know, I like worked out the math is about a third, you know, so it's fair. Makes sense. They were in. I said, cool, great. And I still have that bus today. It's like 100 feet outside that window. The first one. So we ran it up and down that route. We made it just $5. You can ride as much as you want. It was popular. So we bought a second bus. That was popular. We started getting rented for like weddings and stuff, which helped subsidize the work. During the weekends, you know, we'd do weddings, and during the week, we'd drive people to where they need to go. We got into doing tours of the city. There's not really a lot of good tour operators. So whatever we could use these buses for that was helpful for the city of Detroit, we would do. And you know, just grew from there. I mean, it's a old school small business success story.
Was it? What happened to it? You still running it?
The bus company? Oh, yeah.
You are.
Oh yeah, yeah. We have look outside this window. We have like 15 buses right now. We have 38 employees, drivers, mechanics. You know, the whole
wow.
The whole thing.
So you're running a bus company. Why do you want to then go work for Basecamp?
Well, it's Basecamp.
like, is that really what it is?
Well, you could ask to play for the Yankees. Like you're gonna go play for the Yankees, right? Like,
so you heard that they were looking for someone, and you said, "I'm gonna just take my shot and see if an amateur can play for the Yankees, or like an outsider can play for the Yankees."
Well, so Jason sent me an email and he said, "Hey, like you're probably too busy for this, but maybe you know the right person," which I still don't know to this day if that was a ruse or you know, if really like he didn't expect me to apply. Anyway, I went through the whole application process, did not think I had a chance at it. And I got it against like 1400 people, I think it was.
What's your marketing background? Like, what is it about you that allowed you to market the bus company in a different way that allowed you to be a strong candidate for Basecamp?
Yeah. So, you know, bus companies, it's in, again, a very mature market, like, very low margin. It's like, you know, it's like trying to start an airline. Like, you know, you need a lot of equipment. You need a lot of marketing. You need a lot of compliance. Like, you need all this stuff. Thankfully, I knew none of that going into it. And so, you know, I made some expensive mistakes with, you know, no one's ever been hurt. We haven't had any accidents. We've kept all that very safe by hiring drivers who've been in the game a long time. But, you know, we've had some paperwork fines and, you know, we've forget to register the tab sometime. Like, you just end up with problems. So what sets us apart is, this sounds like bullshit, but it's customer service. I mean, like other bus companies just straight up don't answer the phone. They tell you to like fax in your request, you know? So with us, there's like a great web form. There's a funny phone system you can call into. Our people are nice, you know? We have like simple pricing. Like we just take this like old crappy industry and just do it like how you'd want it done, you know? Like how do you want to be treated renting something like this? You don't want to feel like you're, you know, chartering some kind of, you know, critical thing. And just, you just want to email a guy, get a price, book the bus, you know, make it easy.
If I dial you right now, I'm going to get to hear some funny thing.
Well, right now it says, if you need help, email us because we're not going to answer the call.
Because you guys are working on hand sanitizers.
Yeah. And then it says like, if you really need to talk to us, press 2. That's exactly what it's going to say.
How did you promote the bus company? Was it a lot of PR?
It was a lot of earned media, you know. Also, like we painted the buses with local muralists. So the first one was painted by Kobe Solomon. So, you know, I there's a lot that went into the calculus of making the bus company. One of it was like, yeah, I don't have the money to buy a building in Detroit, like, you know, to do some like restaurant or like some other impactful thing. But a bus could be anywhere, you know. So as like neighborhoods change and things morph, the buses are always going to be like wherever we want them to be, you know? So it's like flexible in a changing city. Mm-hmm. But also like they're rolling murals. They're, you know, beautiful pieces of art that, you know, like enliven wherever they are. And it's hard to miss that, you know? So we get the phone calls.
From people who say they want to rent it.
Well, first they say, what the hell is this? and then they go,
is this
can
the
I
first
rent
one?
That's the second one.
The second one. Okay. Yep. I get it. And it says Detroit, the Detroit Bus Company on this one.
Yeah. And we named it the Detroit Bus Company because it sounds like it's been around 100 years. You know, it's like there's never been a Detroit Bus Company. And so I figured it's time.
So what works for you with Basecamp promotion?
As far as strategies that we use at Basecamp,
have you done anything yet or is it too early? For
well,
you personally,
no, we did,
not the other stuff that they did before.
Yeah, I started in September. So we've tried a few things. First, we sponsored Creative Mornings. I'm sure you're familiar with Creative Mornings. It's a once a month meetup at a coffee shop. The coffee and the snacks are free. And you hear somebody from the creative community speak on what they do. It's early in the morning, so you can do it before work. But you hear someone who's been carefully chosen to talk about their work and their life. And it's crazy inspiring, huge movement. It's in almost every country around the world. I mean, it happens all the time. Hundreds of thousands of people meet up for this thing. And so we became one of their global sponsors. You know, we're one of their platinum sponsors just before COVID hit. So, we had done that and we also sponsored a MicroConf, which is, a conference for, you know, solo founders, small companies, small tech. That was about the in-person meetings. And that, I think maybe it was even this weekend. It was like right around now that we were going to do it. And again, it's not going to happen.
Here's my feeling about that. I know about Basecamp. You guys have the brand already within this community. Mm-hmm. I didn't use Basecamp for years. It wasn't until a really good experience where someone managed me through Basecamp came up that I said, oh, I want to do this for our team. It's kind of like Slack. You could hear everyone say, use Slack to chat, use Slack to chat. But until you get involved in a big group where someone Slacks and you're in it and you're Slacking and you say, I get it. It may not be right for this big group, but I see how it works for me, that you get it. I feel like my strong opinion on this is, I feel like what you guys should do is create a project for something. Let us see that project by being in it and experience it. And then we feel it. So if it's MicroConf saying we are all going to get together and launch something during COVID, like a COVID launch, we're going to support you. We're going to be in there and we're going to create these sub projects where you can chat with each other. That's interesting. I wouldn't do it on a big MicroConf is actually pretty big and I'd probably want to test it smaller, but let people experience it and go, oh, now I see why this is better than what I'm used to. What do you think of that?
Right. Right. Well, so for Creative Mornings, we had, help them set up Creative Mornings worldwide on Basecamp. So they were going to work with their chapter leads to organize their projects and, you know, basically get Basecamp into their hands. Because until you see it in use, it's kind of a complex value proposition.
Right. Yes.
You really, if you hear, you know, Basecamp project management software, you're like, eh, like it's kind of a take it or leave it proposition. Like, you know, what's that really going to do for me?
Like, what is it even project management? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Everything. Notion is project management. Asana is project management. So is the task app that Microsoft came out with, right?
Yeah. So our thing is takes a little more to explain. You know, we did some like display ads for through Carbon. Great people to deal with, but it didn't really hit for us just because you can't get it across in 80 characters. You know, what are you possibly going to say? So we're looking for more long form, opportunities now, which is why podcasts are important because, you know, a host eloquently getting across 30 seconds of, you know, why Basecamp matters, or how they use it for their show and their organization. That is way more impactful than, you know, just calling it project management software. It's so much more. It's team communications. Yes. It's, you know, it's document management. Like it's the whole thing. And if you tried to buy each of the services that we offer, each of the tools that we offer, individually, you know, you paid per seat or whatever, it'd be enormously expensive. It'd be hundreds of dollars a month versus, you know, $99 a month just for Basecamp. So, you know,
I got to believe you guys are growing big now because of everyone working from home and looking for remote project management software.
I mean, signups are up. Everything, you know, I actually, I don't keep an eagle eye on signups. You know, I'm more interested in like the stories and the conversations we're having out there, than I am about raw numbers.
What about, Detroit hand sanitizer? I know about it because I've been following you on Twitter. I thought that Jason talking about how he decided who to hire and why he hired you was such an interesting Jason Fried introspective episode of his podcast that I just said, I got to follow this guy. And then I saw you post a couple of pictures, but that's not how you're selling hand sanitizer, right? How are you doing?
Well, we're selling it on our web store. So, you know,
and how are people finding the web store?
Lots of ways. You know, we've got, again, a ton of earned media there. We had Facebook ads for a while. You know, Basecamp is a non-Facebook thing, but unfortunately, Bus Company made its, you know, follower base on Facebook a long time ago, back when organic was really easy. Mm-hmm. And so that's where the customers are. You know, I wish we could get off it, but it is what it is. So we had Facebook ads for a while, and then we got our Facebook ad account disabled because they have a ban on hand sanitizer ads.
And so they disabled you.
They disabled us. Okay. And it's really frustrating because all I get all day on Facebook and Instagram is hand sanitizer ads.
Yeah.
All day. Especially now, you know, because I click them and I see how much they're charging. And, you know, we're definitely the cheapest sanitizer by probably $10 that is actually in stock and shipping online that I can find. Everything else is $55 a gallon, you know, $60, $70 a gallon, you know. We're trying to Henry Ford this out. You know, we want to push it cheaper as possible, you know.
How'd you get the containers? I know this is a small thing, but you can't get containers made in the US, can you?
Oh, yeah. No, they mostly are because they're air, you know. A lot of plastics come out of, you know, Pennsylvania, New York, Ohio. Okay. The containers, there's actually a place like two blocks away that I got a referral to, Porter Bottle. And so we've been buying from them. So we just go over there with our semi truck, load up, you know, come back.
You got a semi truck now?
Yeah.
Wow. I do see the Earn Media. Now that I typed it in, I see Detroit company donating sanitizer to first responders. I saw that. Detroit bus company shifts gears to help people during, I guess that's COVID.
Good pun. Yeah.
Can't read the rest. Yeah. Right. A lot of it is like that. Then there's one pivoting towards here. Detroit tour company pivots during pandemic to make hand sanitizer. But you guys aren't pivoting. You're just adding it, right?
Yeah. I mean, pivoting would mean we're getting rid of the buses, right? So I don't think that's a great use of pivot, but
okay.
It makes sense.
Wow. All right. So you're going to have three big businesses that you're working on. Basecamp, project management, promoting them, right? Number one. Number two, Detroit Bus Company. And number three, you're going to have Detroit Hand Sanitizer Company, which you see as growing even after the COVID fears.
Yeah, it just has to, right? Like the amount of sanitizer that's needed to reopen economies is just millions of gallons, you know? And like hand sanitizer wasn't that popular before. Like you'd have some in your pocket, you might have one in your glove box, but you didn't have a gallon, you know? You might have had 2 ounces.
I thought people were weird who had it. We had it in our diaper bag,
yeah.
The spray just in case, but yeah.
Yeah, it was kind of before COVID, it was kind of a thing for like, I don't know, busybodies or germaphobes or like people, you know,
yeah.
You always see people like doing this to like, you know, getting between the fingers. It's just weird.
Uh-huh. But now look at this in my pocket.
You got one. Yeah.
I wouldn't have bought. I don't have yours. You don't have this size. We just got this. No.
That looks like a 4 ounce, maybe 2 ounce.
And that's the thing. I don't know if I could even trust this company. I got it from Ace Hardware. I wanted to get jars to keep my dried beans and rice. And they had it at the counter. I said, all right, let's just buy this New Life Advanced form. I don't know who they are. I can't tell if they're
legit. Is it a liquid or a gel?
It's a gel. And I saw that you don't believe in gels. You believe in liquid because
liquids,
that's what doctors use. Why the liquid, not the gel? Purell does the gel.
Well, liquid is a hand rub instead of a hand sanitizer. So a hand rub, an antiseptic hand rub is what like a surgeon would use.
Yeah.
Either in a hospital, between visits. Like you've almost definitely seen your doctor, you know, do check up on you, check your pulse, check all that. And then they go on the way out, they get a little pump of liquid that's hand rub.
Definitely. Oh, I didn't realize that. I thought they were using the gel too.
Because the problem with the gel is that it stops it from getting into the little cracks and crevices of your hand. It's slower to evaporate. And a lot of that, like it's an extremely long word, but it's a cellulose based material, you know, that makes it a gel. So it's inferior in every way, except it's not runny. You know, that's pretty much it.
I would have thought that it would be better because it's easier to spread around, where the liquid would dry up too fast or before I could get it all over my hand.
Well, that's why it's an 80% solution. So the water actually helps it slow down the evaporation. The vapor pressure on alcohol is not super high, so it's not evaporating crazy fast, you know?
Uh-huh.
It's not like if you use something volatile like a gasoline or something, you know, that evaporates pretty much instantly. You do want it to be wet for a little while, but the gel is just, I don't know how gel became popular. I think it's probably easier to dispense and to deal with.
Maybe.
And we may offer a gel in the future. It's obviously effective, but the liquid is more effective.
So I got this from Ace Hardware. You're not partnering with companies like that, right?
Not right now. We're doing D2C right now.
Direct to consumer right now, completely.
Direct to consumer, yeah. Yeah, I got to expand the acronym. So we're doing that right now. So mattresses, hand sanitizer, all D2C. but we'll do some distributor stuff in the future. You know, I want to make it as accessible as possible, which means grocery stores, which means public markets. You know, we're partnering with Eastern Market, which is the big outdoor food market here. Because until people can just walk up and just buy it with cash,
right,
you're really not going to get it to the people that need it most.
What about deliveries through like Grubhub? If I could have had one delivery service deliver it, I totally would have. I couldn't get any of the delivery services to do it.
It's a pretty good idea. Yeah. We talked about local delivery, but you know, UPS, it's like $9 to have them bring it safely, deliver it, sign for it. You know, it's really hard to beat shipping, actually.
No. Oh, really? I was thinking like Mercado or, you know, these services that will deliver from grocery stores using the local delivery people.
Yeah. Yeah. The problem with that is a lot of those services, you need to have a credit card. You need to be banked to be able to do that.
Oh, and you want to get to the unbanked too?
That's our main goal. Yeah. I mean, if you look at the numbers of who COVID is hitting, it's hitting Black America way, way, way harder.
So then how are they coming? They're coming to your website and buying if they're unbanked?
Well, no, that's the problem. That's what we want to solve for, is we want to be able to offer this at grocery stores and public food markets where people who are unbanked can get access to it.
Got it. You're such a freaking do-gooder, dude.
Well, I mean, like, your city's on fire, right? Like, it's like, you know, it's like the great fire in Chicago. And like,
yes,
you're just standing there with a bucket of water. Like, what are you going to do? You're going to start hucking buckets. Like, you got to do something. So
I think most people would say, I'm drinking the water as I make my way to another city that's not burning. But for you, no. It's, I love this city. I believe in it.
No, I think most people, I subscribe to the Penn Jillette thing, that the vast majority of people would throw the water. They would help out. You know, it's, they would help.
I think you're giving people more credit. I think they might be just lazy sitting on the couch going, damn it, somebody should have done something. And then that somebody ends up being you. And the thing that, that gets me interested in you is, you're a regular person. You're just like creating stuff. I think that there are a lot of people who've listened to my interviews who said, I never even thought that, never thought that entrepreneurs are just regular people who come from regular people backgrounds. And now that I saw this story, I feel like I could do that too. I think the same thing is happening to me and other people with you. It's like, I thought do-gooders were like these precious few who go out and have something, but they're like regular people like you. And it's interesting.
Literally everybody is a regular person. I worked earlier this year for, 2019, a couple months I worked for like a very super A-list, person, who, you know, I really like, and, helped him a lot with the, you know, digital media stuff. And, he's a regular dude, super nice, regular guy, like, you know, but when you look at the avatar of the media persona and the presence, it can look so much bigger and, you know, so much more spectacular, but like, thankfully everybody's just a regular person, you know?
You know what? No, I want to say yes and be nice here. I've got to tell you, living in San Francisco, I hate it. I want to get out of here. But the one thing that I do really admire is I go to my friends' kids' parents' houses and just talk life, and the way they analyze things, it's not like regular people analyze it. The insights that they have from the relationships that they've built and the experience that they have, it's not the same analysis. It's a different analysis. It's a different way of thinking about the world. That's really interesting. Different sets of opportunities. I see that on a regular basis.
Well, they're optimizing for their environment. Like, you know, if you need to make that much money to stick around in that city where you're trying to raise your kids, like, selling hand sanitizer by the gallon is not going to cut it. you need to VC some big complicated thing. You know, it just, I think you're a function of your social circle and your locale. Like, it, if everybody you ever associate with is only talking about signing big VC deals, you know, that's what you're going to think about, what you're going to do. Detroit is a depressed, hardy, durable city. You know, everybody says hi here on the sidewalk because we've got this big shared trauma of, you know, staying in this dying Rust Belt city. It's just, I think it's the people who are left behind are, you know, really rad. Like,
I would either be traumatized by being in that environment or I would get out. And I like your approach. You're just you. You're smiling as I say that to you, because that's who you are. And it's kind of interesting to me.
Well, we had a lot of people leave. I mean, a lot of my graduating class from my school, like a bunch of them left, and for a while it was like a badge of success. Ooh, you know, she went to LA. Like, that's like, she won, you know? But then you see 3 years later, they're coming on back, you know? It's like, you always got to come back to where your parents are. But like, we're in truly like a global economy now, like in a way. And so like, you can largely live anywhere and still participate at the top echelon of whatever that thing is. It's not like to be in media, you have to be in Manhattan.
Yeah.
Is it helpful? Sure. Like, you might end up at the right cocktail party. But there's people who are really excellent at things, world-class at things, who don't live in the centers of those anymore because of I don't know, the internet, you know? So like Detroit is an excellent home base, smack in the middle of the Midwest, very excellent. And I can go anywhere I want and I come home and I know all the streets, you know, I know all the people.
Thanks so much for doing this interview. I obviously did not do the read for my second sponsor for TopTal. I didn't want to interrupt the conversation when it was flowing. So I'll do it again another time. I will say this from the same like heart that says it's not a good time to do a TopTal ad. Comes a person who says to you, I wouldn't tell you to go check out ClickFunnels podcast if it wasn't right for you. And I'm not telling you to listen to it forever, but I'm telling you to sample it. And if it jives with who you are, you're going to pick up some really good marketing techniques from people who know it, who've done it, who create software for it, who've been around it for years. So the interview is done. If you want hand sanitizer, you can go to, it's still Detroit Hand Sanitizer Company, right? .com? Detroit Bus Company is where it's located.
Yeah, right? We named it Detroit Sanitizer Company kind of just to be funny.
You know, yeah, it's but it's still available at thedetroitbus.com. That's the URL, right?
That's the URL.
And then when you're ready to sign up for another podcast, just go subscribe to Traffic Secrets from ClickFunnels and TopTal. I'm sorry I didn't do the ad. I'll do it again. Thanks so much, Andy.
Thanks, man.
Bye. Bye, everyone.